Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Neil Boulanger from the BC Aboriginal Network on Disability Society. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with BCANS.
Thanks, Cam. So we've been quite busy. We've got our conference coming up. We had to reschedule it from November to March 2019. It'll be held on the 27th, 28th, and 29th. So we're hoping for good attendance from across Canada, from both the Indigenous sector, disability sector, and Indigenous and non-Indigenous persons that come together and help develop partnerships and strategies, new collaborations to really help out the Indigenous disability sector in Canada, because we see that often information awareness and partnerships are lacking, and there's a number of reasons why, but we're hoping that this will be a catalyst to bring different groups together, different governments together, to start working more cohesively together to address some of the barriers that are facing the people that we serve. We also have, of course, in November and next month is Indigenous Disability Awareness Month here in British Columbia, in Saskatchewan. It's also been officially declared and recognized by the Assembly of First Nations, the Métis Nation BC, First Nations Summit, the Yukon Council of First Nations Chiefs, and a number of other not-for-profit organizations across Canada. So we're preparing for that here at our office, and we're going to have a small event at our office, and we're also hosting one with a university on the mainland. So it's been pretty busy. We've contacted all the senators, all the MPs, all the cabinet ministers to give them information about the month and hopefully to get their support for it. We've also included a BCANS pin for each of them to wear throughout the month to really highlight their support for Indigenous persons living with disabilities in Canada and the very valuable contributions that they bring to all of our communities. So that's been keeping us busy. Next week, I have the opportunity to travel to Ottawa to present to the HUMA committee at the House Commons, under the House Commons, to talk about the new federal accessibility legislation, Bill C-81. So we think the legislation is a good first step, although there's a number of areas we want to take a look at and make recommendations for change. But, of course, from our perspective, the legislation does not address First Nations. And there's over 600 First Nations in Canada, and we are unsure right now how this legislation will impact First Nations people living with disabilities. So that's the main point we're going to be conveying to the government, to the committee, is that, you know, we have to take a look at this. What's your plans to do engagement? They have indicated that they're going to engage by nation to nation to see if the legislation in its entirety or partially will be applicable within First Nations communities. As well, the AFN has passed a resolution last year requesting a First Nation-specific legislation. So these things are all unfolding now, but the critical message is that regardless of whether there is a distinct First Nations legislation, whether First Nations are fully or partially under the legislation, that things have to change and the government has to be prepared to ensure that funding is in place to address accessibility issues within First Nations communities.
So what are some of the biggest accessibility challenges currently facing First Nations communities?
Well, I think, you know, every community is different, but we did a consultation with the federal government in relation to legislation over the last 2 years, and we contacted First Nations across Canada to ask about those things, as well as federal government service providers. So the big things that we've seen are certainly the built environment, the physical accessibility barriers, whether that means that common areas or community buildings are not accessible, or there's limited roads, sidewalks, you know, just the physical layout of the communities. Accessibility isn't always planned for in housing, social housing, that type of thing. Another big thing that we've identified and was really overwhelming was discrimination and racism and how that affects the ability of people to access services or their even willingness to access those services. So those are things that really stuck out. Policies as well, the government's policies, how things work within the community or what they can use certain programs for, they have to all be reviewed and allow some flexibility in there because although there are, you know, many programs that are available, there are not that many that are specific to disability, and those things have to change.
So if you could send any message to our leaders and to the community about why it is First Nations have to be included in any disability legislation, what would you say?
Well, I think I've been reading some of the human reports, and the Canadian Human Rights Commission, I think, summed it up best is that, I can't remember the year specifically, but prior to 1988, First Nations were not included under the human rights. And this was supposed to be a temporary thing, but it lasted for 30 years. We can't get into the same routine. I mean, there's a lot of people living within First Nations communities across Canada that live with disabilities. We know that, you know, Indigenous disability is twice that of the non-Indigenous population in Canada, and that should be a priority. And when we look at accessibility legislation under the federal system, it would, to me anyways, be a no-brainer that 634 communities where people live and work and grow up and have children would be under that, and that would be the priority area. So my message to government is that regardless of how this unfolds, whether it's a distinct First Nation legislation or whether it's the legislation that will be developed, communities have to be covered, and you have to work with them to identify their specific barriers and provide the resources to address on an ongoing basis, you know, and on a go-forward basis.
So what are the next immediate steps as you prepare for the change?
Well, we're just going to keep working with governments in our communities, and the AFN is a strong partner, and the Native Women's Association of Canada is a strong partner. They work with us on some of our recommendations that have already been forwarded to the government, and we'll just keep continuing to do it. So we have to see what that engagement process is going to be, the nation-to-nation engagement process that the government has committed to. And we'll continue to work with the AFN to see how that unfolds. And from there, we'll make subsequent recommendations with our partners and, you know, guided by our community's input and our clients that we work with and move forward.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks, Cam.
In this segment of our show, chatting with Holly Sein, will be telling us a little bit about Prader-Willi syndrome. So tell me a little bit about the Prader-Willi's Association.
Prader-Willi Association, the Ontario Prader-Willi Association, was an association that was developed over 30 years ago by a number of parents that children were diagnosed with this condition. And it's really supporting families and being advocates for the families throughout the life cycle of an individual that's diagnosed with Prader-Willi syndrome.
So can you tell me a little bit about the syndrome itself and how it affects a person?
So Prader-Willi syndrome is a rare genetic condition. It occurs in approximately 1 in 15,000 live births. There are three different ways an individual can have Prader-Willi, not as important for this discussion. The main most notable characteristic is an insatiable appetite. And what that means is individuals with Prader-Willi, as they get older, they go through different phases of hunger and satiation. And sort of 8 years and onwards, they have this desire and thrive to eat all day long. They don't possess the mechanism to stop eating like a typical yourself or myself. After we eat, we recognize, our body recognizes to stop eating, and we stop eating. Individuals with Prader-Willi do not have that mechanism to allow themselves to stop. Other areas it affects their growth, their muscle mass, their muscle-to-fat ratio, it affects their eyesight, it affects their sleep patterns. They often suffer from sleep apnea. It affects their cardiovascular system. So just a multitude of health conditions actually around Prader-Willi. So it's a very intense disease for a caregiver to manage, and one of the most challenging, I think, as individuals age and get into adulthood is the mental health.
So when you mention the compulsive eating, in that sense, it's similar to bulimia, I'm guessing.
No. It's I don't know the mechanism of bulimia, but I guess sometimes the easiest way I describe it is, it's a pathway in the brain. It's a communication between the hypothalamus in the brain and the rest of the body that manages metabolism, and there is a disruption in that pathway, and so no matter how much an individual eats, their body is not recognizing that they have eaten anything. Other ways that it's different from bulimia is that individuals with Prader-Willi actually cannot, they will not vomit. So unfortunately, if not completely restricted and watched all the time, they could actually have a stomach rupture. And so it becomes actually a very life-threatening condition.
So how do you go about providing services for those affected?
So the Ontario Prader-Willi Association, with our executive director and our board of directors and multitude of amazing volunteers, our mandate is to improve the quality of life. And that would be an advocate in the education system. A child will go to school and probably that school, they will only have ever had one child with Prader-Willi. So just really educating them on how to work around the food and the behavior around managing their food. We're also advocate in the healthcare and medical system. Again, most doctors, general pediatricians or general practitioners have only treated, a handful of individuals with Prader-Willi. So we support that. We also support and advocate for residential. So when a child is discharged from high school, really figuring out how they can be effective and live a sustainable and fulfilling life as an adult, which would also include in the workplace. So we will support that. And we also support KinderCare, which is the only medical practice that sees Prader-Willi patients from birth right up through adulthood. There's two doctors there, and they see over 100 patients. So we're starting to really build and advocate that practice so that more families can get care with doctors that are familiar with the condition.
So in your time with the association, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Sorry, a successful moment?
Yes.
Maybe. So I've been with the association since 2014. My son was diagnosed with Prader-Willi that same year. He's now 4.5. So I've been heavily involved and currently sit as the co-chair. And I would say just last year, we had our 10th anniversary of Shadow Lake Camp, which is a camp that we help subsidize for families that occurs every May-June timeframe for anyone 16 or older that has Prader-Willi. And it's a camp solely for individuals with Prader-Willi, which provides a very calming, safe, fun environment for these individuals, and also provides a great week of respite for the caregivers. And so very proud that we've been able to sustain that camp for 10 years. And we're actually working towards getting funding to start a teen camp, to start getting the younger teens to find a camp in the summer as well, because right now, currently, it's still difficult to find a camp that can manage the food issues with Prader-Willi. I would say that's the highlight for me and what I really work towards every year.
So if you could send any message to the community about this condition, what would you say?
I think as a parent and knowing a lot of families that are living with this condition, it's a condition that's very can go very much unrecognized because the child or the adult can seem fairly typical. But the food causes such anxiety to them. So family gatherings, restaurants, anytime we go out in public and there's food around and it's not controlled, the individual with Prader-Willi is seeing the food, smelling the food, and it completely distracts them. So I guess my message is, if you know of anyone with Prader-Willi or our family member of anyone with Prader-Willi, just to really understand that the challenges around the food are very difficult, and to consider what the family needs and ask of you. Also, I think the other thing I would love to say to the community is the Foundation for Prader-Willi Research is also very important, and there's a lot of research going on to try and help find a way or find a medicine that can stop this constant drive to eat. So those would be my two messages.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, thank you.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're hosting friends for a night in, exploring new restaurants and breweries in town, or going out to your favorite watering hole, please drink responsibly. Designate a sober driver, call a taxi, a friend, or just stay over. Thank you for always driving sober. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Neil Boulanger about the impact of new federal disabilities legislation and the effect it's going to have on Aboriginal peoples with disabilities, and from Holly Sine, who told us a little bit about Prader-Willi syndrome. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Michelle Shelley, who will be telling us a little bit about her latest research into disabilities in the justice system. So your latest research relates to segregation in the criminal justice system.
Yes. So I'm, Cam, I'm looking at the problematization of segregation in Ontario's correctional system, and I'm looking at human rights, public policy, and the lived experience. So pretty much in Canada, mental health issues are at least 3 times more common in the prison system than in the general population. And on November the 14th, 2017, there was 609 inmates that reported to be in segregation cells across the province, with 373 of those were identified under the Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Service policy as having a mental health disability. And in recent years, you know, both levels of government, provincial and federal, have come under intense media scrutiny regarding how inmates are treated across the country. And in reaction to this, the Correctional Services and Reintegration Act was introduced in May 2018, and pretty much that act is set to take action against and transform the adult correctional system to produce better outcomes for individuals in custody and upon their release. So my research, Kim, is really looking at that pretty much the problem of segregation requires interventions that are willing to bend and reproblematize according to changing social-cultural dynamics. And I think that at present there's a gap in the literature that ties the lived experience of segregation to human rights. And I think that this limits the conversation by really masking the problem.
So
go ahead.
I was going to say, wouldn't this tend to amplify anything, any sort of mental health situation for somebody going in? Say they don't have a mental health concern before being segregated, wouldn't?
Yes. Yes, no, of course. You know, there's an extensive and broad body of literature that suggests that segregation is psychologically and physiologically damaging for inmates, and it can cause or worsen mental illness, and it's really irrespective of the amount of time spent in segregation. So that being said, I mean, one day could really have an impact on someone to be locked up in a cell for 23 hours a day with no meaningful social connections whatsoever.
So how is it that anyone can survive this sort of inhumanity? I mean, you'd have to figure it would have a potential for suicide or other such concerns that somebody being that on their own, and worse still, if they're innocent and they find that they shouldn't have been in there in the first place, you're creating a condition right there.
Of course. No, most definitely. And, you know, this research project that I've submitted to complete my dissertation on is really looking at that. It's really looking at how do inmates survive in segregation, and how can that lived experience of segregation really inform practice to protect human rights and increase safety? And I'm wondering really how the ministry's diagnostic tools are used to classify inmates as mentally ill. So in the new act, the new act that came about in May, the Correctional Services and Reintegration Act, the act is really suggesting that they are putting things in place to protect individuals with mental health issues to ensure that they don't end up in segregation. So they've come up with the inclusion of segregation prohibitions, a 15-day consecutive maximum, independent review teams, but the act also lists exceptions to these policies. So, for example, Ken, like segregation prohibitions list having a mental disorder as a protected ground that meets the prescribed conditions, but the act does not define what those prescribed conditions are. So pretty much the absence of definition within the act is actually can actually create policy loopholes that can place inmates at a greater risk for human rights violations.
So wouldn't it come down to kind of a judgment call based on the individual prison and the experience? And if you catch somebody with a firm understanding of what a mental health condition is, they might stand a better chance.
Yeah, and I think this is really that's why my argument is really coming back to it's a human rights violation. The problem is not necessarily putting in more rules and policies, and that's not the issue. The issue is that it's against people's human rights. It's not okay, and people are spending more time in segregation over the years than they ever have in the past. And despite, various human rights legislation such as the United Nations, the Nelson Mandela rules, which has affirmed that segregation should only be used as a last resort, and any time spent in segregation past 15 days is cruel and inhumane. But yet we have reports that in 2016, 1,300 inmates in Ontario spent 60 days or more in segregation.
So
these are the things that I want to really unpack to really reframe this problem as a human rights violation.
So in that vein, isn't it a little more difficult than just your standard practices monitoring? I mean, people in free society might have a chance or a recourse, someone they can talk to. Would be a little more difficult in prison, but this research is trying to break down those walls, I think.
It really is. It's really trying to give inmates the opportunity to speak and to share with what's been happening to them. And my hope is that experience, through that lived experience, we can re-engage in this conversation from a human rights lens to ensure that, these inmates need to be managed. We need to see inmates within their wholeness, and we need to understand that these inmates will be released back into society. And we need to assist with that reintegration. I think we don't need to be producing more people with mental health issues in prison and then releasing them with nothing. I think that we're going backwards, to be quite honest with you. And I think if we want to be progressive, I think that we need to to move away from that safety and security narrative and instead start talking about human rights and what do we want Canada to stand for? What are our values? How do we protect people? Some of the most vulnerable people in our country, in our society, are in prison, and they need to be protected.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you, Cam. I appreciate being on your show.
Amazing though it may be, my friends, fact is, whether the person is free, incarcerated, native, not native, no matter where they're coming from, it's all about recognizing their value. No matter what they've done, what they might have said that might have hurt somebody along the way, what cultural background they're coming from, no matter who they are, they have a right to be respected and considered. The truth of the matter is, what Michelle was describing in her interview is taking away the only freedom that those prisoners have. The only kind. Because if the mind is free, the body knows far less of the pain, their circumstances. And yes, the possibility does exist that an innocent person may walk into prison completely innocent, completely healthy, walk out with a mental health disorder, and we, as a people, will have put them there for no reason whatsoever. This is not a knock on the justice system, but it is a possibility. The truth of the matter is, no matter what laws we have to take into consideration the simple humanity of everyone. No matter what their circumstances may be, financially, culturally, no matter how people might view each other, the truth is, we're all here, and we all are part of this great tapestry called life. No matter what the condition, what the situation, we all have to keep open minds and open hearts, or progress will never be made. If we can't look beyond those little things that we're not comfortable looking upon or comfortable talking about, some of the difficulties, how do we hope to overcome them? If we can't have a conversation with somebody who may have made a mistake in society and say to them, I know what you did, but you're still human. You're still entitled to that consideration. You can't have that conversation. You'll never know what really matters to them in terms of their situation. Same is true of Aboriginal peoples. The fact that Neil wants to have that conversation with Aboriginal peoples about how this law impacts them. A law is no good unless it applies to us all, unless it's universal. If it's not there to serve all the people, what's it there for? To make ourselves look and feel better? No. It can't be form over functionality. It can't be that we forget anyone in society, no matter who they are, where they are, what they've done. We all make mistakes, and we all have our different backgrounds, our different viewpoints. That's how it should be. Not a matter of judgment, but simply to learn and grow by each other's wisdom. That's what life's all about. And we need to find it within ourselves to have those conversations and to get it recognized that we are all part of this tapestry. Without any one of us, the picture is not complete. You can't take into consideration every type of background, every type of disability per se, but you can give it your best shot. Saying we can't fill every nook and cranny shouldn't stop you from making the effort, because the more we grow, the closer we get to that. And we must continue to work towards it. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.